from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the versatile novelist Mary Mackey and her latest book, a historical novel called The Widow's War. Plus, poet and translator Tim Kahl and his new collection, Possessing Yourself, and new classical music recordings on the latest edition of Sound Advice. But first, the prison system is one of the most pressing policy issues in California today. Federal judges have ordered a steep reduction in the population of California's overcrowded prisons. At the same time, the state's money problems have forced cuts of over $1 billion to the prison budget. But lawmakers are having a tough time agreeing on how to make those cuts. Also at issue is whether California should have a sentencing commission to try and take the politics out of sentencing guidelines. All this was the backdrop for a recent opinion piece in the Sacramento Bee by criminal justice system expert Michael Vitiello. He's a professor at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law and has been active in the campaign to reform California's sentencing laws. He's on the phone with us. Michael Vitiello, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's always good to talk to you.
In your opinion piece, you wrote that cutting the prison budget by perhaps $1.2 billion is, quote, a potentially healthy development. Why would that be?
Well, you know, I think that most of us agree in California that what we want is sensible expenditure of our resources. Conservatives are always criticizing excessive government spending, except in this instance. Now, when I talk about excessive government spending, I assume that we all also agree that, by and large, what we want is to protect public safety and that spending more money than necessary to do that is a waste. So we can have it both ways if we do it smartly, intelligently.
Aha. Well, that's the crux of the matter. How would we do it smartly or intelligently?
Well, to take it out of the political arena, I'm assuming you may ask me about this case of the abduction of the young girl. Our public policy on criminal justice has been driven by headline, aberrational, terrible headline cases like the Polly Class case. These are aberrational cases, and we ought to have a system that protects against those kinds of crimes. But many offenders in prison are well beyond the kind of those kinds of dangers. Those are the think about crime as a pyramid. The largest numbers of crime are pettier offenses, and as we climb to the top of the pyramid, we get the violent offenders. But we're spending too many of our resources in California up and down the pyramid, not focusing in on the top.
If $1.2 billion were to be cut, well, when that money is cut from the prison budget, it's hard to see how the prison system could keep all the prisoners confined who are currently in the system when you cut that much money out of it.
Sure.
And in any case, federal judges have said you
That's
have
right.
to reduce the prison population. How can you do all that without endangering the community?
Well, first of all, let me make one other very important point. Let me show you some of the choices we're making right now. In order to keep this inflated prison budget, what we do is we're cutting expenses from elsewhere. And every criminal justice expert knows that it's far more important to make sure you have certainty of punishment than the severity of punishment. So what we're doing is we're cutting resources, and I don't even want to get into the debate about cutting education funds and the like, but what we're doing is cutting other kinds of funds. So if we have to cut, for example, mental health services, and we cut drug treatment services, and we cut police services, we are now increasing the risk on the street. So at a minimum, we're making those kinds of choices right now to keep this budget. Then the second thing you do is you go through the pressure. The political process has created very, very long sentences. The headline case then produces a new sentence enhancement for the crime du jour. So we have these very long sentences. So what you do is you weed through the system and you see how much punishment do you need to protect the public against this kind of offender. And then you also shift some money to much less expensive to have intensive parole supervision for high-risk offenders and the like. So there are a number of ways to do it. And let me let you on a little secret. If you go outside California, even to far less progressive states, you find these kinds of systems in place with similar reductions in crime that we've experienced in California. So other states are doing it much less expensive than California, doing it sensibly.
Give us an example of a state that is doing this that you think California could learn from.
Virginia and North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Both are purple states. They've got very effective sentencing commissions in place. Here's one of the things that I think is quite fascinating. I think it's in Virginia. They have a piece of legislation that if you want to put a new sentencing enhancement in the hopper or create a new criminal offense, you also have to explain to the legislature, in effect, and to the public, how are you going to pay for it? What are the implications going to be? How many more beds are we going to need? So you can actually see the kinds of choices you're making. You know, outside the context of criminal justice, that kind of accountability is something that most Americans probably agree on, that we want to have accountability and effective use of resources. Certainly conservatives do every time any kind of liberal agenda is proposed. Why not use the same kind of sensible approach to criminal justice? What kind of bang are we going to get for our buck? And we don't have a very good system right now.
We're talking about cutting the prison budget in a way that would not endanger the community and sentencing commissions. My guest is Michael Vitiello, law professor and director of the Center for Advocacy and Dispute Resolution at McGeorge School of Law, part of University of the Pacific. Earlier, you alluded to a high-profile child abduction. I assume you're referring to J.C. Dugard, who was abducted
yes.
in 1991.
Right.
Recently, she was found. Philip Garrido, the man who kidnapped her, most people would look at him and go, how did this guy get out of prison after 11 years?
Right.
What do you say to people who go, well, if someone like that can get out in the streets early, why should I not be concerned about a wider scale reduction of the prison population?
That's right. Well, I alluded to it earlier. Not everybody fits the same profile. That kind of thought that here's somebody who was let out on parole, he commits a terrible crime, therefore letting anybody out on parole creates a terrible risk. Well, that simply doesn't follow. It doesn't follow as a logical matter. The other thing is, one of the things that has emerged in recent years, guess what? Computers allow us to use data far more effectively. And one of the things that there's a very important movement now recognized by all sorts of organizations that are looking at prison reform. Center, left, center-right organizations are all looking at this notion of evidence-based sentencing and then parole decisions based on predictive data. I have no access to this fella's history other than the same kind of information that we see in the newspaper. But if you look at the kinds of profile for high-risk offenders, he probably would have fit within that category. I don't know, as I say. I don't have the evidence in front of me. But if you use predictive data, if you look at the nature of the offense and the nature of the offender, you can greatly reduce risk. Let's just take a few simple cases. Very old and very ill offenders. There are organizations around the country that have used actuarial data to secure the release of very old offenders without any recidivism. That's a simple way to save a few million here, a few million there. But to quote Everett Dirksen, you know, a million here, a million there eventually adds up to some real money. So that's there's your answer.
Sure.
You can't drive policy on the extreme example. Of course, that's a terrible, terrible situation. But the logic that flows from it has to be examined carefully.
The California legislature is trying to cut the prison budget by $1.2 billion, but the Senate and Assembly attempts to do this are quite different from each other. And one of the main differences is the sentencing commission that's in the Senate.
I know.
And the sentencing commission that is not favored by the Assembly. That appears to need to be reconciled. You wrote about a sentencing commission idea, the general idea of a sentencing commission in your opinion piece.
Sure.
Now, the point of a sentencing commission is to take the politics out of sentencing and to come
right.
up with guidelines. But
right.
what's to stop the legislature, or for that matter, the voters, from still reacting to the crime du jour and going, we don't care what the sentencing commission says,
right.
we want to clamp
right.
down
right.
here.
Right, of course. Well, there are a number of protections you can build in. You know, one of the things I alluded to in the piece, and anybody who's studied sentencing commissions around the country and widely adopted in roughly half the states, one of the things you realize when you study sentencing commissions, they're not a panacea. They can be done well or they can be done badly. So one thing you can do, and that's what or some of the early fight was about when this was proposed, oh, I guess over a year ago, was what it takes to overturn the commission's recommendations. So one of the things, you ought to make it difficult, a little bit like the base closure. You know, you ought to get a proposal and then make it difficult to overturn it so that you allow the sentencing commission, you give the sentencing commission a task, and the task will be how best to use the resources that we have available. Do we have infinite resources, Jeffrey? I don't think so. You may have noticed lately that we don't. So tell the commission, all right, this is what we have to spend. How are we going to do it? We've got this many beds. How are we going to use them? What kind of felons do you want in those beds? So you start out with that. One of the criticisms, by the way, is that it violates somehow the notion of democracy. Well, you know, the very same people who make that kind of claim are the people who hold us up every year on the budget process with a minority party controlling the budget process. So for me, the challenge to people who oppose a sentencing commission is if you want the current prison system, increase taxes to pay for it. If you don't, then come up with a system for using the available money effectively. And we don't have the money to spend, so let's use it effectively. So how do you prevent the legislature from coming up with the crime du jour? Well, one way might be to build in legislation like I suggested earlier. If you want to increase punishment, you have to explain, part of the process would be to explain how you're going to come up with the money to pay for it. You ask, some commissions have statisticians, some really good ones out there, and they can tell the legislature, if you enact this bill, it will need X beds. It's going to cost you this much money. And then the legislature has to come back with an explanation how they're going to fund it. Well, that's a really good way to have responsible legislation. You can't just play to the public, that we're protecting the public, and leave for somebody else cleaning up. That's what we're doing right now. We create a prison system that's too expensive to maintain. We're, you know, we now dump the problem in the laps of three federal judges who are trying to clean up our mess. We won't take responsibility for it. So that's the system we have now. There are ways around it. The commission, let the commission come up with, tell the commission how much you have to spend, and then figure out how to spend it, and then build in some limitations on changing the law.
Michael Vitiello, law professor at University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. His specialties include the death penalty and sentencing. And he's been active in the campaign to reform California's sentencing laws. We've been talking about the sentencing commission that might or might not come about in California as one way to control the state's prison budget. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Good. As usual, a pleasure. Jeffrey, thanks.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, poet Tim Call and his new collection, Possessing Yourself. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Ever wonder how we manage to cover so many topics and book so many guests on Insight? Interns are a big reason. You'll find details on the careers page at capradio.org. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, is the war in Afghanistan one of choice or necessity? Plus, what lessons are being learned from the J.C. Dugard kidnapping and how various authorities handled it and her kidnapper over the years? That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The widely published Sacramento poet and translator Tim Call has a new collection. It's called Possessing Yourself. Call's poems have been published in dozens of magazines and journals, and he's translated into English poems by German and Portuguese-speaking authors. He's also vice president of the Sacramento Poetry Center. He's in our studio. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How long did it take you to pull together your book? Did you sit down to write a collection, or did these sort of emerge over a period of time and then you thought, I've got a book?
Well, that's an interesting question. I really kind of came through it through the back door. I had started out writing in a kind of more experimental mode where I would get away from writing about poems that used myself as the subjects. And then I came to Sacramento, and nobody was really interested in that kind of experimental work. And in order to prove myself as a poet, I suppose, I had to start writing in these more lyric tradition, this kind of traditional, you know, self-oriented types of poems. And so over the course of several years, I started to put together the collection and I'm writing those kinds of pieces. And I kept sending out these more experimental ones, and they kept coming back. So I said, you know what, I'm just going to take all of these kind of first-person poems, put them together, and put it into a collection, and that's what people liked.
Well, I'd like to hear a couple of your poems. One that I chose, I like it, is called Lutheran Prayer.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that one. It's a poem that I think is pretty close to myself autobiographically, and it's a poem that is fairly serious, I guess. It's called Lutheran Prayer. I am serious. I repent. Sins stock the shelves alongside all the ordinary career plans. I call Mr. Fix-It to reconstruct my life. From the beginning. No, starting halfway through. Halfway through my life, I am finding enough time to rethink what has happened to me. This rethinking is serious business. And a Lutheran God is nowhere in sight. I pray for the dead weight of my family to anchor me and hope I can imagine the rest.
That's Tim Kyle reading his poem Lutheran Prayer from his new collection called Possessing Yourself. You said it's somewhat autobiographical. What do you mean?
Well, there are many poems in here that are close to my life that come out of my direct experience. But then there are other poems where I take these kinds of imaginative flights of fancy and project out of myself. There are poems that I do in other voices, like I'll have a poem that I do in a Grover voice from Sesame Street. I have poems where I break into song in the middle of the poem as well. So there are times where I try to get outside of that, and it's not just me and my life and my experience.
Now, those voices and songs don't really come out when someone reads one of your poems, when they read it in a book.
Well, for one of the poems, I actually have a little in the brackets to be read aloud in the voice of Grover. And I'm not sure what a reader is supposed to do with that, but... for the most part, they're poems to be performed in that regard. And that's why I wanted to include some of those poems in there, because I like to read those kinds of pieces aloud at the Sacramento Poetry Center and elsewhere.
One of your poems has a little song in it, and that's called Dead Air, and it's got the fight song of the Chicago Cubs. Are you a Cubs fan?
Big Cubs fan. Big Cubs fan. I grew up in Chicago, and for whatever reason, my sports allegiances remain there. I have a brother who still lives in Brookfield. So, yeah, the Cubs are a big deal. I'll listen to them, pretty frequently.
Here's another poem from your collection that I enjoyed reading, quite different from the Lutheran Prayer. This one is Fallow Crypt. First of all, could you explain the title for us?
Yes, a fallow crypt is the penis sheath that the Dani tribesmen wear, and it's part of their regalia. You can also purchase these, I'm told, at Zanzibar Trading downtown. So if the holiday season is coming up, that might be something you want to look into. So it's a piece called Fallow Crypt. I decide to run naked on the slip and slide in my backyard, my wife warning me about head and neck injuries. My two sons bear all as well, genitals flailing like miniature wings. My wife warns that the neighbors in the two-story can see over the fence and tell who has been circumcised and who hasn't. But we are a little tribe of suburbanites, unfazed by who is gawking at us. Like the Dani tribesmen of New Guinea, whose fallow crypts must endure 1,000 tourists' photographs. They believe birds and humans once lived together. They have words for only 2 colors. They are great models for us who are trying to simplify our lives, who are still a little confused by all the publicity given to private matters and all the influence given to men who wear the pants.
That's Sacramento poet Tim Carl reading the poem Fallow Crypt from his new collection, Possessing Yourself. Is that based on a real story?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we moved into the burbs there in Elk Grove, and we put the old slip and slide out there and had a good time with it. In fact, I think this is the first summer that we didn't get the slip and slide out, and I'm missing it a lot.
Have your boys read this and gone, Dad?
Well, no, not really. Not that one so much. A lot of times they star in the poem, so they like them a lot. I have one that's called, it's not in the collection, it's called Junk Food Weekend, where it's basically mom goes away and we load up on a lot of different junk food, and they'll get up and sing that, parts of that with me as well. But they generally are pretty good about that kind of thing.
Another poem, if that's the right word to use, from your collection that caught my attention, is called Confidences. And the reason why I say poem, if that's the right word to use for it, is it looks like a very short piece of prose. It's written in paragraphs, very correctly looking, sent justified on both sides. Is it a poem?
Yeah, well, it's a prose poem. It does have a very strong narrative thrust, but it belongs to that tradition of prose poetry.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Okay, Confidences. I have trapped a moth here at the hotel in this foreign city. It is my pet. During the day, I leave the window open and let the moth bring back more stories from the city. Each night, it returns with descriptions of street vendors selling grilled meat on a stick, the crowded lovers' plaza full of those who still believe in sharing passion in the daylight, a man in a straw hat sleeping underneath the palm tree where his boat is tethered, his cell phone ringing next to him. Each night the moth returns, or at least I think it is the same moth. It would be very unsettling for me to learn I have been bearing my soul each night in this little square room to a series of strange creatures floating above me from moment to moment, unsure of whether they are attracted to me or the light.
The poem called Confidences. Did something concrete trigger this poem?
I was in Vitoria in Brazil. I was teaching there for a number of years back in the 90s. And there was a moth that came into the room at that particular time, and I had been having all kinds of adventures in Vitoria, and it just seemed to me that this little moth was trying to tell me about those million untold stories in the city.
Along with writing your own poems, you've done a lot of translation. You've translated German language poets, German and Austrian poets, and Portuguese language poets from Brazil. Mm-hmm. How did you come to speak those languages well enough to be able to translate poems from them?
I think I came to translation because I studied with a very well-known translator, Clayton Eshelman, who has won many awards for his translations of Cesar Vallejo, the great Peruvian poet. So he kind of indoctrinated me that if you're going to be a poet, you have to translate. And then when I went to Brazil, I found that a good way to learn vocabulary was to try to translate works. And, I kind of got into it in that regard. The German is something, because I have German heritage, that it was around the house. I was aware of it. I don't speak that well. I think it's somewhat of a misnomer that you necessarily have to speak the language perfectly and fluently. I know Clayton, even though his Spanish is quite good, always relies on a second reader to kind of help him make sure that he has the various different idioms down and so on and so forth. But for the most part, it's just something I threw myself into. And I personally wish more American poets would try to do that. I think many of them are scared because they feel, oh, I don't speak it fluently. I better not try that. Sometimes, you know, you can go a long way with a little bit of help from a dictionary.
Would you be nervous if a poet in a language that you don't speak decided to translate your poems into their language?
No, it's happened. I have a friend that I met in Brazil, Miguel Marvila, whose works I have translated, and he tried to, translate some of my works and showed them to me. And, you know, he made an interesting comment on some of the poems that I had translated of his, and he said that, well, it wasn't exactly what I had intended, but I kind of like your version better. You know, so sometimes you don't hit the nail on the head, but you can come out and produce something that is interesting in that language that it's coming to, which I think is the primary motivation for translation, if you ask me.
Tim Kahl, the poet, his new collection is called Possessing Yourself. He's reading more poems from it at the Sacramento Poetry Center on Monday night. The Poetry Center is at 25th and R in Midtown Sacramento. Tim Kahl, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me, and we'll see you there. All right.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the eclectic novelist and poet Mary Mackey. Her new book is a story of a woman's struggle for justice during the Civil War. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. The eclectic novelist and poet Mary Mackey has enjoyed a lot of success. She's sold well over a million copies of her books, and they've been translated into 11 languages. She's also a recently retired professor of English at Sacramento State. Mary Mackey's new book is a historical novel called The Widow's War. It's set in the early years of the Civil War and is about a woman's struggle for justice. She joins us, Mary Mackey. Nice to talk with you.
Nice Insight. To talk to you. Good morning.
Your previous book was also about a woman during the Civil War. Did you come up with the idea for this one while you were writing the previous one?
All of my novels feature strong female characters who are often involved some kind of struggle for social justice. So it was just a natural segue into this one.
How did you figure out who was going to be your character and what was going to happen to her?
Well, I first of all became very interested in this portion of the this is sort of the Civil War you don't know about. This is the Civil War before the Civil War. And this takes place in, by the way, this is Brazil Day. Part of it takes place in Brazil. She's raised in Brazil. And then she ends up in Kansas there was a hot going Civil War in Kansas for 7 years before the Civil War broke out, with real violence and slavers and abolitionists fighting each other. And I started reading about this history and I thought, this is a story that every American should know about, but very few of us remember it, even if we had a little of it in grade school. And I decided to do what I love to do in novels, which is do a lot of really meticulous historical research and then put a character in there who has passion and emotion and who's real and who moves through it. And so you kind of get the history painlessly. And so it came really with the idea of the topic and the history and then putting her, immersing her in it.
My guest is the novelist Mary Mackey. Her latest is The Widow's War. We'd love to hear you read from the beginning of the book. Is there anything? I mean, this is the beginning of the book, so we probably don't need any context, but is there anything you'd like to say before you start?
Oh, just a little bit. The beginning of the book is, the book's circular, so this is sort of the end and beginning of the book. You get something the book then flashes back a little earlier, but this is also the story of the first African-Americans to fight in the Civil War, an African-American unit trained by John Brown, and I just want to remind people that John Brown was the guy who attacked Harper's Ferry and in some ways in cited a lot of the things that led to the Civil War, but he was actually in Kansas during the time of Bleeding Kansas before this and very active there. So here we start out, and you don't really need much context. It's in the voice of the main character, Carrie, my heroine, and it's the Kansas Territory, September 1856. 9 days ago, I shot my husband. Tomorrow, I'm going to lead a band of escaped slaves into Missouri to free 8 women, 4 men, and 3 children who were kidnapped by Henry Clark and his band of border ruffians. Actually, the escaped slaves are going to lead me. They were trained in the art of war by John Brown himself, and God help any slaver who gets in our way. When I throw the divining shells and look into the future, I can see that this is only the first battle in a civil war that will soon engulf the entire nation. That war is racing east right now toward New York and Boston, Richmond and Savannah, crackling and roaring like a prairie fire, and there's not a thing any of us can do but prepare to stand and fight. Henry Clark welcomes this war. For the past week, he's been hunting me like game. He's plastered a poster with my description on it on every side of every jail in western Missouri. Wanted: white woman, age 25, brown eyes, blonde hair, 5'5" in height, approximately 120 pounds, slave stealer, abolitionist, station master on the notorious Lawrence Line of the so-called Underground Railroad. Goes by the names Carolyn Vinton, Carrie Vinton, Carolyn Sailor, and Mrs. Deacon Pressgrove. He got most of the details right, but that poster also contains additional information that reads as if it were composed by a madman, which leads me to believe Clark himself wrote it. Armed and dangerous, I take as a compliment. But what am I to make of the charge that I'm known to consort with satanic spirits or kill men from afar by mysterious means? Clark makes it sound as if I'm wanted for witchcraft. I wonder what he'd have written if he'd known I was coming after him with a cavalry unit of black soldiers.
Wow, what a start to the book. The book is The Widow's War. The author is the novelist Mary Mackey. I love the wanted poster. My goodness, they're really stacking the deck against Carrie.
They really are stacking the deck against Carrie. And those wanted posters really did exist. The issue at hand was whether or not Kansas was going to come into the Union as a slave state. There was a law, a bill passed called the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which always sort of rattles around in your mind as something you've heard of, but nobody really remembers what it was, at least I didn't. And it said that people in Kansas could vote, that Kansas Territory could vote to see if they were going to come in the Union slave or free. And there was no residency requirement. So everybody went, the slavers came in, Missouri was a slave state, they came into Kansas. Abolitionists moved out from New England with whole towns and built towns in Kansas, and the two fought in a bitter war for 7 years in Kansas. So it's a very passionate, bloody situation. There was even a time when an abolitionist senator was almost beaten to death on the floor of Congress by someone, of the Senate, by someone who disagreed with him. So this is a very flashpoint in American history.
When you were doing your historical research into the Civil War and that era,
yeah,
what did you uncover that you felt really passionate about that motivated the book more than perhaps anything else?
What really motivated me passionately about the book were two things, really. I was fascinated by the fact that the Underground Railroad was active in Kansas, stealing slaves out of Missouri. We say stealing because they were property, of course, stealing slaves out of Missouri and running them to freedom. And that it was run a great deal by free people of color and African Americans as well as white abolitionists. So there was a coalition there that really functioned in a way that I found very, very interesting. I was also fascinated by the fact that this was a real war, that Lawrence, Kansas, an abolitionist town established by mostly immigrants from Massachusetts that opposed slavery, was attacked by an army of several thousand men, burned, the presses were smashed, people were killed, the town was looted. And this happened in 1856. And this was an attack on an American city by other Americans that I had not known about till I read about this.
My guest is the novelist Mary Mackey. Her latest book is The Widow's War. As I said earlier, your previous novel, The Notorious Mrs. Winston, was also set during the Civil War. I mean, these are events that happened some time ago, but they were in America, and we still feel the effects of the Civil
Absolutely.
War today. But you've also written historical books set in prehistoric Europe and nearly prehistoric Mesopotamia. Why do those situations also appear to interest you?
Well, I am sort of, as I say, mugged by ideas. You know, they just come out of nowhere and get me, and I have a lot of ideas. Most of them are no good, actually, to tell you the truth. And every once in a while, I find an idea that I want to read about. I love history. I love reading about history. And those four novels, actually, that take place in prehistory or near prehistory, were all inspired by the ideas of a different kind of attitude toward the earth, looking at the earth as a living thing, as a sacred thing. And I became very interested in them because I think now we're trying to figure out where we went wrong in treating the earth as sort of a large parking lot instead of looking at the kind of the living relationship between us and a living being, which is the Earth. So that was inspired by that whole idea. I often take contemporary problems and look back in history and look for the roots of them, or look at things that if we knew about it might help us understand things now.
Now, by way of contrast, you also write comedy novels under the name Kate Clemons.
Uh-huh, that's my disguise.
Yes, and when I look at the covers of those books, all that pink and these sort of sassy young women suggest that they're chick lit novels.
They are. And I decided to write, you know, it's interesting why I wrote two novels, one called The Stand-In and one called Sweet Revenge, which is about a woman who runs a revenge service, people said I should go into the service. I'd make more money than writing novels. And I wrote those actually when I was after September 11th, when I was feeling very depressed. And I thought, what this country needs now, there are plenty of people doing the mourning. And what I need is a place to escape to. And so I actually wrote those novels as an escape to kind of help me keep my balance and sanity. So I'd go into the novels and feel good about it, and then I'd come out to the kind of grief that was racking the country. And so those were actually comic novels that came out of grief.
On September 19th, I read that you're teaching The Secrets of Writing Great Dialogue at a bookstore in Corte Madera.
A book passage in Corte Madera, yes.
Give us one tip to writing great dialogue.
One tip for writing great dialogue is that you have to get people talking. And if you want to get people talking, they have to ask each other questions from time to time. So I'll give you two tips. Hey,
good.
You know,
okay.
This is free. Another thing is dialogue's not just dialogue. So when you write dialogue, it should be doing something else. It should be revealing character or telling you something about moving the plot forward. It shouldn't just be an exchange, because dialogue can be really boring if it's just reply and, you know, if it's just dialogue. Dialogue is doing a whole lot more than most people realize.
Mary Mackey, the novelist, her latest book is The Widow's War. She's also a recently retired professor of English at Sacramento State. This evening at 7, she's at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento. Mary Mackey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's more Insight coming up. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, some new classical music recordings on the latest edition of Sound Advice. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check us out on Facebook and become one of our fans. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. It's Thursday and time for our weekly music feature, Sound Advice, with new, reissued, or otherwise notable recordings. The first Thursday, it's classical music, and with me is Kent Teeters, morning host on the classical station here at Capital Public Radio. Kent, welcome back.
Hi, Jeffrey. Good to be here.
Well, you've got new recordings for us, and as it happens, one of them features a well-known conductor who died this week.
Well, yes, indeed. I had planned on doing this recording because it came in last week. It was released last week, but it's from Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops, and it also involves young performers who have appeared on From the Top, our program that we air on the classical station Sunday afternoons at 3 o'clock. Eric Kunzel died on Tuesday, this past Tuesday, at 74. He battled cancer for a long time. He joined the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra back in 1965 when the Cincinnati Pops was spun off from that group in 1977. Kunzel took the helm, and together they gave countless performances and entertained millions of people, literally millions of people. And with Telarc Records, he made more than 85 recordings. That future is in doubt. I just learned this morning as to whether they're going to continue. They are going to continue with the Pops season and use guest conductors. But this recording came in just last week, so it's very fitting that we talk about him and talk about the recording.
The recording being From the Top at the Pops. And the first excerpt we're going to listen to actually includes a young woman from Northern California.
When she recorded this with the orchestra, she was 12 years old, Hilda Huang from Palo Alto, and she plays the Piano Concerto No. 5 by J.S. Bach.
Thank you.
It's Sound Advice on Insight. My guest is Kent Teeters. He's the morning host in the classical station at Capital Public Radio, and we're listening to a new release, From the Top at the Pops. It's music from the From the Top program that you can hear on the classical station. And the conductor is Eric Kunzel, who just passed away this week. The next person we're going to hear is a violinist, right?
A young violinist named Chad Hoops, 14 at the time of the recording. There's a photo of him included in the liner notes of the CD, and he reminds me of a young Itzhak Perlman. He has that same intensity on his face and those same cherub-like figures. And I'm not sure, but he might be on his way to playing like Itzhak Perlman someday. Chad Hoops, and here he is with the finale from the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Max Bruch.
That violinist, Chad Hoops, only 14 at the time of the recording. It's astonishing, isn't it?
It just really is. I mean, we've had contests in the past, you and I, with this segment. And do you think you could have determined if he was a professional or not?
Not at all. I mean, I would have certainly erred on the wrong side.
Well, now this next one is quite special. Every now and then, the From the Top program has a young composer as a guest artist. And before we listen to the music of, he was then 19 years old, he's now 20 and he's studying at Yale University, composer Stephen Feigenbaum, I'd like for us to get our ears around the music of Gustav Mahler so we can compare Stephen's sound with the sound of Gustav Mahler. And this particular excerpt is from the Symphony No. 6 by Mahler.
Wonderful late romantic music by Gustav Mahler, which we're listening to. So we can contrast that sound with the sound of music written by a very young composer, Stephen Feigenbaum, who's on this From the Top CD.
He says he borrows from the romantic repertoire of slow string movements, and it's just remarkable how much he sounds like Gustav Mahler.
My goodness, that's such intense, mature music for a 19-year-old to write.
I think there will be a lot of good music created by this young man, Stephen Feigenbaum, and he's a junior at Yale University. That's the Serenade for Strings by Feigenbaum and the late Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops performing the piece. And you know, I'm just really thinking about the fact that Kunzel is gone. It's so hard to believe.
And that CD, this new release, From the Top at the Pops, music from the show From the Top that you hear on the classical station.
And in fact, without making this a complete commercial for the classical station, the live broadcast of that particular program is coming up on Sunday, September 20th at 3 p.m. So we'll be able to hear the live performance. And then after they did the performance, they went right into the studio and made the recording. So there's no audience noise on the recording at all.
And let me just add, too, that we actually interviewed Eric Kunzel last October on Insight, and that interview's been linked to today's Insight webpage at capradio.org/insight. What else do we have, Kent?
Well, the Boston Symphony Orchestra does it, the Philadelphia Orchestra does it, the London Symphony Orchestra does it, and this is another example of a major orchestra that has begun to record and release under their own label. The Dallas Symphony Orchestra, under their new music director, Jaap van Zweden. The DSO and Jaap van Zweden are in their second season together, and the audiences, the critics, and even the musicians in the orchestra are all in accord. They say that the performances are wonderful and that this is a brand new era for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Last year, they recorded the symphonies number 5 and 7 by Beethoven. This year, Zweden and the Dallas Symphony Orchestra have a new recording of Tchaikovsky's Symphony number 5 and the Capriccio Italian. And I was going to go back and listen, have us listen to Gustavo Dudamel, but we probably better move ahead.
Yeah,
and let's listen to the DSO's version.
But that was very crisp and assertive, the way that started out.
It's a wonderful performance. Also on the recording is the Capriccio Italian, and I think you can really hear, if we have time to get to the middle section, we'll start with the beginning, the very warm sound that this orchestra gets. It's different from the older recordings from the Dallas Symphony. It sounds to me like the Vienna Philharmonic, but this is the Dallas Symphony Orchestra.
But that is really nice.
It is a warm sound. It's a rich sound. I mean, the Dallas Symphony Orchestra has always played well. But when you stop and think about it, it's not really on everyone's radar as being one of the world's great orchestras. It's a good orchestra. It's an excellent orchestra. Don't get me wrong. But I think this is a brand new era for the Dallas Symphony under Jaap van Zweden.
And their new recording we've been listening to of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5 and the Capriccio Italian. And we're going to go out with more music from that album. It's the waltz, isn't it, from Tchaikovsky's symphony?
The waltz from the Symphony No. 5 by Tchaikovsky. Again, this is a great recording, and it's available through their website. To my knowledge, that's the only way to get it right now. It's dallassymphony.org.
Kent Teeters, morning host on the Classical Station here at Capital Public Radio, joining us for our weekly Sound Advice. The first Thursday, it's classical music. Kent, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Kelly Minimar and Michelle Grafis. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.